what drives ventilation, right? Elevated PCO2, decreased O2 drives ventilation. So sleep and ventilation are very much tied in together. However, you could see how unfortuitously certain patients could be at risk of developing certain disorders depending on their anatomy of the upper airway, specifically talking about obstructive sleep apnea syndrome. The upper airways, if it's too basic, please forgive me, but I just need to review this in just a few words. The upper airway is a area anatomically divided into the nasal passages, retropalatal, retrolingual, and hypopharyngeal. But the upper airway has a unique feature. It serves to do three things: to ventilate, to eat, and to speak. Cannot do more than one of those at the same time. So it has to be pliable. It has to contract and dilate, depending on the function that you're doing. So it sets the stage for, if you will, excessive collapsibility of the upper airway that results in upper airway obstruction. Also, when we look at bony structures, we see only the hyoid bone, which is really a floating bone. Everything else, apart from the nasal passage and the hard palate, everything else is kind of redundant, flopping, and so on and so forth. So if you have a redundant uvula and soft palate, or a thickened tongue, or disorders such as acromegaly, et cetera, which increases muscle tissues, you can see how the upper airway can impede ventilation, especially during sleep. So let's talk about sleep. So what happens to the upper airway during sleep? Well, we recognize that decreased motor neurons down to the upper airway have a decrease in muscle contractility of the upper airway dilators. And this results in decreased caliper, which increases airway resistance and collapsibility. That's fine and good if you have a normal upper airway. So in summary, we recognize that upper airway resistance increases during sleep. Hypoventilation with decreased motor output to the from the motor neurons to the ventilatory support system is the, if you will, the main findings, which sets the stage for hypercapnia, hypoxemia, which drives ventilation. All right? So that's the premises for understanding the pathophysiology of obstructive sleep apnea. There are different kinds of apneas, and when you read reports from physicians and interpretations, please take a moment and just take a look at what you're reading and get an insight into the patient. The majority of the patients that have sleep apnea, the majority of them are obstructive sleep apnea. Even in patients with central sleep apnea, the majority of them have an underlying obstructive component. Even if the diagnosis is central sleep apnea, pure central sleep apnea is very rare. And in fact, during my career, it was often central sleep apnea was followed by a long-standing history of obstructive respiratory events that led to decreased cardiac output that results in Shane-Stokes ventilation, as an example. So now I'm seeing a lot of patients early on in life, good thing, before they develop cardiovascular disease, and if you capture them early, you prevent them from evolving into a more serious type of respiratory events. Once again, our discussion today is purely obstructive sleep apnea, which is the majority of respiratory events you're going to see in sleep studies and one of the rationales for you sending patients for evaluations. So what is the definition of sleep apnea? Well, the word implies want of breath, which means breath-holding spell, usually lasting 10 seconds, followed by two key, very important factors that they don't have to occur together, but the results of decreased ventilation results in desaturations and a termination of an arousal. Why? Because if you don't breathe again, you're dead. So it's imperative that ventilation reoccurs. Of course, the most important thing you need to do from birth till death is to ventilate, of course, no matter what all of us think otherwise. If we look at graphic representation of this, on the left-hand side, you see the obstructive, they had decrease in flow, and there's still effort. If you look at the chest and abdomen, if you're breathing against a closed epiglottis, you have paradoxical ventilation. I know that that's not what you're seeing here, but basically you have decrease in flow or absent flow, and that's the center of your above your nostrils, and excuse me, nostrils and lip, and efferent is still there, so that means that the brain is still sending signals to contract, and if you look at different channels, it's usually paradoxical, which implies the upper airway is occluded. All the way to the right, that's what central is, and some of my colleagues, and that includes me, believe that mixed apneas, if you notice, it starts out with central and then followed by a respiratory effort. Most of my colleagues and myself believe that a mixed apnea is actually an obstructive event that overshoots the apnea threshold that results in a central apnea followed by obstruction. So if you treat the obstructive events, the mixed apneic events disappear. So truly, it's not central. What is the prevalence? And this is old data from Young and Keenan back in 1993. We look at individuals between the ages of 30 and 60 years of age. The prevalence, more common in men than females, and race, African-Americans, Hispanics, and Asians have a higher predilection of sleep disorder breathing versus Caucasians. If we were to look at 65 years of age on up, which is my patient population here in the Boca Raton Sleep Disorder Center, so certainly this incidence is much higher than that. And so I'm always presented with colleagues asking me, every patient that I send you has sleep apnea, and my answer is, that's the reason you sent the patient to me. You're doing a great job screening those patients. They do have sleep apnea, but they happen to also be it's a very prevalent disorder and very common. Now, whether we relate to their presenting complaints, that's the clinical relationship that you do with any test in clinical practice. So the first thing you recognize in the upper airway in patients with obstructive sleep apnea is this individual on your right. And if you look at the characteristics, the first thing you notice is nice long neck, shorter neck with fat pads and fat creases in the back of the neck. Second is you look at the airway, retropalatal, retrolingual, hypopharyngeal, nice airspace is noted, whereas the patients with obstructive sleep apnea have a narrow upper airway. And I'm not referring to nasal passage, but retropalatal, hypopharyngeal, and retrolingual. The other thing is submandibular fat pad is another feature, and you can tell that this individual is obese or overweight, and the neck size is much larger than this side. So we recognize that this is from Schwab back in 1998, which I borrowed his slide, is basically looking at individuals with obstructive sleep apnea. They have a smaller airway. So now you have decreased motor pathways, motor neurons to the upper airway. You have decreased dilatory response, and now you have the work of breathing, the workload of trying to keep the airway open as these muscles of the upper airway relax. And by the way, the muscles, of course, of the upper airway, it's a skeletal muscle. So part of the physiology of sleep is to produce progressive muscular relaxation, right? That's why you can't really sleep standing up, although physicians, we're pretty good at it. But having said that, and future doctors that I see, but as a general rule, if you fall asleep and you're sitting, you usually slouch, you lose muscle tone. So the upper airway is no different. It does lose muscle tone, results in increase in airway resistance, decrease airway caliper, and if your airway is small, that predisposes you to obstruction of the upper airway. An example of this is you're looking at the major muscles of the palate and the major muscles of the tongue, genioglossal tongue, tensor palatini. These are dilatory muscles. In an awake individual and non-REM, you can see a decrease in muscle tone. In a sleep apnea patient below, please note the effort to try the, if you will, accentuated effort to maintain the tongue and the palate open during ventilation. Once sleep occurs, you lose that motor neuromuscular control, and therefore it's inadequate to maintain airway ventilation, and therefore the upper airway collapses and obstructs. This is well represented by Douglas and Mortimer back in 1997. If I put a mask on you and I suck out, that's called negative pressure, the response of the upper airway muscles, and you could see the different muscles there, palatal, glossal, and levator palatini. As I increase the pressure of the horizontal plane, the muscle contractility increases exponentially. And a sleep apnea patient does not have that compensatory response. Once again, the work of breathing on a collapsed airway does not have the compensatory response to maintain the airway open, therefore results in collapsibility. So this is a slide that I borrowed from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, basically to summarize the pathophysiology of obstructive sleep apnea. We start with an individual with a small airway and some neuromuscular compensatory abnormalities. At sleep onset, we talked about decreased motor pathways from the medulla to the upper airway, lose or loss of neuromuscular compensation along with decreased pharyngeal and retropalatal muscle activity that leads to airway collapsibility, and then obstruction of the upper airway occurs. At that point, again, the brain has no clue. It's a pathological disorder that the upper airway is occluded, but it recognizes two things. Number one is that there is an increase in effort to breathe. That right there sets the stage for the brain saying there's something wrong. Second is a drop in SaO2 and, of course, an increase in PCO2. That sets the stage for hypoxemia and hypercapnia, which increases ventilatory effort. The brain recognizes that once you lose your lung reserves, that's why respiratory events can be as long as 24 seconds. That's the average, but it can be up to about a minute and a half to 2 minutes, at which point the brain says, forget it. We need to survive. We need to live. It produces an arousal, which is a partial awakening. What happens to muscle tone as you partially awaken? It returns. The upper airway activates. It restores itself. Airway opens. You alleviate the hypoxemia and hypercapnia. And for those individuals that are the bed partners and watching this process occurring, when they resuscitate breathing, it's an abrupt uncorking the bottle of wine. One or two breaths to resuscitate, recover the PCO2 and O2 abnormalities, and the brain goes, okay, we're done. We're in the sleep mode. Back to sleep. What that means, that the individual has very little to no recollection of those events. And that's very important from a clinical perspective. Because you ask the patient, do you hold your breath at night and wake up gasping? That does occur, but not as often as the bed partner providing that history. In sleep medicine, bed partners are very essential in providing observation of what that individual does on a night-to-night basis is almost as good as a sleep study. The consequences of obstructive sleep apnea are twofold, sleep fragmentation and cardiovascular complications. So let's start just one or two words about sleep fragmentation. When you get those sleep reports from your sleep physician referrals and you see the diagnosis of obstructive sleep apnea and it says mild, moderate, severe, take one more second and just take a look at what they mean by the number of events per hour. If you think about it, an apnea hypopnea index, apneic events, 60 per hour, one per minute of sleep. Now, you lay in bed, try to sleep, and have your partner every minute shake you. Go back to sleep, shake you, go back to sleep. So you could fathom that a sleep fragmentation from any condition, but definitely obstructive sleep apnea, can cause increased symptoms of excessive daytime sleepiness. So sleep fragmentation is one of the causes of excessive daytime sleepiness. There's some discussion whether hypoxemia plays a role in affecting the awake centers of the brain. It takes a lot of hypoxemia and sustain in order to affect those centers of hypervigilance in the posterior lateral hypothalamus. On the cardiovascular implications, so how does the arousal and hypoxemia cause that? Well, of course, as you recognize, hypoxemia is not detrimental to the cardiovascular cerebrovascular system. So the implication is the cardiovascular complications, if you will, cerebrovascular complications, are as a result of the arousal response that produces an accentuated sympathetic tone, which results, of course, increased peripheral vascular resistance, which causes free systemic hypertension, atrial fibrillation, and, of course, causes issues with endothelial abnormalities resulting in transient ischemic events, TIAs, and myocardial infarction. So repetitive respiratory events results in daytime sleepiness and cardiovascular, cerebrovascular implication, which results in medical conditions. There are many ways that it can present: the daytime sleepiness, job performance, mood disorder. Family discordance is always a big deal because he makes so much noise, as John says, makes a lot of noise as we get older. You know, that's a discordance that occurs between family members. They sleep in different rooms, et cetera, et cetera. Decreased quality of life. Motor vehicle accidents, big time. So if I tell you that the classic obstructive sleep apnea individual is 30 to 60 years of age. He's overweight. He has a thick neck. He snores. Have you visualized truck drivers as an example? Can you imagine? And it doesn't have to be male or female, but mostly are males. So these guys driving 18-wheelers next to you while you're on I-95 or whatever, going on a trip. So you could, you know, you can get an idea of increased motor vehicle accidents. And this guy's, you know, he's driving a weapon that could kill a lot of people if he dozes or falls asleep. And there's been a lot of regulation by the Department of Vehicle Transportation, the FAA, trying to regulate the amount of time, how many hours they need to be awake, how many hours do they need to have break, supposedly sleep, not partying and drinking alcohol. But nonetheless, there's been a lot of regulations to try to improve the performance and vigilance in air pilots, truck drivers, et cetera, school bus drivers that drive your children to school. The cardiovascular complications are the one that stands out most, and in the literature, in the internal medicine literature, that's been pretty much kind of panned out, is patients with systemic hypertension. And this is thought to be secondary to constant increased sympathetic tone, which causes increased peripheral vascular resistance. And if you continue to have repetitive events night after night over a period of years, then you have sympathetic tone memory recall, and therefore you have increased sustained peripheral vascular resistance that doesn't wax and wane. And it's typically early morning hours they have accelerated hypertension or resistant hypertension. Cardiac arrhythmias in the literature, internal medicine, once again, and cardiologists, increase in cardiac arrhythmias, typically atrial fibrillation. So now the question is, when you have a new onset of atrial fibrillation that doesn't seem obvious cause, you ask, do you snore? Male or female, do you snore? Are you sleepy during the day? Cardiovascular disease, transient ischemic event, high incidence, and, of course, pulmonary hypertension for the pulmonologist in the audience. The mechanism of cardiovascular, cerebrovascular is, once again, sympathetic hyperactivity with increased catecholamines. Again, this is as a result of the arousal response, insulin resistance, and all these improve with the treatment of obstructive sleep apnea, which we'll get to in a second. During the upper airway occlusion, there are secondary arrhythmias that in the past, I'm talking about my earlier years, sinus bradycardia, sometimes sinus pauses lasting less than 5 seconds. Those patients might have gotten a pacemaker in the clinical setting of obstructive sleep apnea. That seems to be of importance, but once you treat the obstructive respiratory events, the sinus pauses and all that disappear. So, again, 24-hour Holter monitor is something that you want to kind of look at. Pulmonary hypertension, as you know, it's a very serious condition. I don't mean idiopathic or primary, but secondary pulmonary hypertension. When there is a decrease in flow in the pulmonary function test, 73% of those have a higher incidence of obstructive sleep apnea. Please note they don't respond to oxygen supplementation, but rather nasal CPAP and tracheostomy. This is an old slide. Tracheostomy is not one of the things to do. One of the things that struck me early on when I was seeing patients is this morbidity, mortality. If you look at the 5-year survival rate of patients with untreated sleep apnea, it's pretty bad after 5 years. Now, these, of course, were very not mild cases. These are patients with severe obstructive sleep apnea syndrome. It's important, once again, when you get your interpretation, if you're managing those patients, take a moment and take a look at mild, moderate, severe, and look at the index of severity and desaturation. It isn't just yes and no and just say call it a day. What are the risk factors? We recognize that obesity, body mass index, 32, 35 on up. It gets worse as we get older. Once again, as I mentioned, the prevalence that I showed you was between the ages of 30 and 60. Males more common than females. And so how would that be? How does that relate to that? Male testosterone, snore-inducing, snorogenic, estrogen, progesterone, snore-protective. So ladies start having increase in incidence of obstructive sleep apnea around menopause. So guys trying to replace your hormonal replacement therapy, everybody wants to feel good and get growth hormones and take testosterone because my T levels are low. Just be careful that you're not exacerbating obstructive sleep apnea in those individuals. Anatomical abnormalities, which I'll show you a few. I find this quite interesting. There's no gene yet defined for obstructive sleep apnea, but yet there's a certainly familial tendency that I see from very often in my practice. And smoking has really been, that shouldn't even be there. Smoking is not necessarily related to obstructive sleep apnea. Other conditions, and the classic one for me is that I've seen here in the hospital years ago, one of my first consults that I saw here, I saw an individual with hypothyroidism who got to take his medications for 3 or 4 weeks or slightly longer, and I was asked about the patient because the nurse witnessed apneic events. And, of course, clearly the patient had severe obstructive sleep apnea. He also ended up having obstructive sleep apnea either way, but once you corrected the thyroid and regained his apneic severity improved. Acromegaly and Down syndrome because of craniofacial anomalies, large tongue, megaloglossal for those individuals. The history, what you want to see in those individuals, they often snore. Does obstructive sleep apnea patients always snore? No. So 89% of the patients with obstructive sleep apnea snore. You have 11% of those patients that have obstructive sleep apnea that don't snore. What's the mechanism there? I don't know. Usually you want to look at your bed partner and talk to the bed partner and do they observe this? If you ask the patient, they go, no. Then the next question is, why are you here? Because she said I have a problem. That means you don't have a problem? No. Remember, it's a guy. We don't like to admit we have a condition, right? I'm fine. Really, I'm fine. Dime a dozen. That's how they present. With the bed partner, it tells it all. Oh, he gasps and snores. He's been doing this for a long time. He's getting worse over time. Started out snoring mostly on his back. When he went to his side, got a little bit better over time, not only back but side. And now he's starting to do this, grasping, holding your breath, and so on and so forth. You always want to kind of get an assessment of their daytime sleepiness. And again, the bed partner is always a much better view of that. But there's some screening tests that you could do at your bedside called the Epworth Sleepiness Scale, standardized in about 8 languages. You can't go wrong with that. It's a good way to looking at excess of daytime sleepiness. And sometimes I have the bed partner actually fill out the questionnaire itself. These are some of the physique characteristics of these individuals. They're more often males. They have obesity in the upper part of the airway, meaning chest and neck, thick neck. They have increased neck size, hypertension, and abnormality of the upper airway. And the more and more upper airways that I see, the more difficult it is for me to understand. I mean, some are quite clear, and I'm going to show you a couple of pictures of some of my own patients, but some are quite clear that it's hard to differentiate if that's abnormal or not. So I want to share with you, this is published in the literature by Young and several years ago at St. Louis, and he put an acronym of Stop Bang Questionnaire, something that you could do in your office. S stands for snoring, but not just snoring. This is snoring that's increased over time, can be heard outside the room with the door closed. Doesn't have to be constant, but the snoring is increased over time. It's frequent. Not necessarily positional in nature. Tired could be replaced by sleepiness or not feeling rested or fatigue. Observe events. Again, the patient never knows that. That's the importance of getting the bed partner. If they have hypertension, body mass index 35, age of greater than 50, neck size 15 and a half inches, and more prevalence in male. If three or more are answered yes, those individuals have an increase in risk of having obstructive sleep apnea. Three or more, looking at specificity and sensitivity. Is this specific to one condition? Is it sensitive? Yes. Is it specific? No. But it's a good start to kind of look at the salient components, body mass index, neck size, male gender, history of snoring, not feeling rested, hypertension. If I haven't said that 5-6 times already, that's the key factor here. So three or more are answered yes, you have perhaps a potential patient that has obstructive sleep apnea. So again, these are some of my own personal collections of patients. So this is a guy that I was interviewing, and this is an example of nasal resistance in a patient that snores. Now, you can fathomably say, all right, so you correct the nasal passage and the respiratory events will improve. As I mentioned, that the upper airway is very pliable, upper airway, but what has structure is the nasal passage. So the nasal passage can obstruct but does not obstruct. You got your mouth. You open your mouth. If the nasal passage obstructs, you open your mouth. But we recognize that patients with nasal resistance have an increase in propensity for increased negative inspiratory pressure, which causes further collapse of the upper airway that's already small. That's why the breathe right strips can work. Okay, here's a normal upper airway, the tongue, the palatal arch, the uvula is tucked underneath because he went, ah. And this is a patient with kissing tonsil syndrome. Okay, you could clearly see, and this is an adult. So that's a very narrow airway where this is nice and open. You could see on the side, scalloped tongue, I have a better picture of that. This is a patient with prominent palatal arches. This is a patient with enlarged tongue. Does not have amyloid, does not have Down syndrome. This is just an individual. The tongue is larger than the oral cavity. Therefore, you see the indentation of the teeth. And this is Pierre-Robert syndrome in an adult. This is maxillofacial insufficiency. And this is where a surgeon can actually do some myomotomies and actually move the jaw forward and realign the teeth. A lot of stuff to do. But nonetheless, you could see this individual, and the profile tells it all. You know, if you draw a line from the upper lip down, you could see there's a lot of mandibular insufficiency, and besides, it's a little small, so it's underdeveloped. So, all right, so now you have understand the mechanism, you understand the major symptoms, now it's time to test or not to test. And I got 20 minutes. Okay, I didn't know, time went out fast. Okay, so when is it time to do a test and which is the appropriate test? So nowadays, there's a lot of technology for the last 15, 20 years about doing sleep studies at home. And so the standard of practice, the gold treatment is actually, the gold standard is to do it in a sleep center. But that's not a panacea. Looking at obstructive sleep apnea syndrome, you have a case with all those characteristics. A home sleep study is a viable option for those individuals. Okay? However, my patient population are on their upper years. And they come to either your office or somewhere, or somebody comes out there and delivers 24 wires that are supposed to insert in place, and they're going to get a test out of that. What do I do with this? Weren't you told? In other words, it's not always as easy as it sounds. There are some newer systems that are out that are relatively easy to apply. The easier the system is, the limited the amount of information you get. Most of the home sleep studies looks at ventilation, nose and mouth, and effort. Looks at heart rate, not EKG, looks at oximetry, and some sort of airflow and body position. All right, so it doesn't really give you information about sleep. Is that important? Yeah, the patient presented to you with excessive daytime sleepiness and you were trying to figure out why they're sleepy. Once again, if you think obstructive sleep apnea is high on your list, you can consider a home sleep study. So the home sleep study, you can measure how many apneas they have, divided by your total sleep time, Wait a minute, there's no sensors on the head. Oh, divided by your total sleep time, times 60 gives you how many apneas per hour. That tells you the severity. So you see limitations that both studies have. A home sleep study versus a in-lab sleep study. A limitation in lab in sleep study. Your patients have all told you about my lab and whatnot. It's uncomfortable. I don't like the bed. I didn't like the technologies. He had a bad breath. It was not a good day. The bed was too hard, too soft. Da, da, da. Let's face it. It's not a terrible test. And you're coming there to sleep. Wow, that's really, I'm really putting you a lot of pressure on you. But you know, it's some patients are really disturbed by that. So, and you know, their privacy and their personal issues. Yeah, I get that. So again, an obstructive sleep apnea patient, you have a clean cut case, nothing else. You're not thinking restless legs, parasomnias, nor other sleep disorder, central sleep apnea, hypoventilation, all that. Forget home sleep study. Obstructive sleep apnea only when you have a good screening test, the stop bang questionnaire. Patient has a high incidence of obstructive sleep apnea clinically, then that's a great time to do a home sleep study. And the patient is dexterous and understands English. I don't have any instructions in Spanish or any other language so far, but I'm sure that you could find them anywhere. The second problem with these tests is the interpretation of the test. Who does it? Who reads them? And anybody's actually looked at them unless a computer is actually going to do these. And so that's a very important thing, the validity of the outcome of the test that you ordered, that you're looking, and now you're taking charge of that case. So again, you're responsible for who read it and what does this mean? I don't know if I helped your complicated things, but this is the laboratory. This is the old Frankenstein way of monitoring patients, and I still have two of these, but I don't use them. And of course, this is the analog. So this is analog and digital. Digital has made life monitoring patients a lot easier in a sleep lab. And this is a sleep lab, an example of sleep apnea. Look down towards the bottom. You see a drop in ventilation, paradoxical chest and abdomen that result in awakening. But look at the EKG, sinus pause. And this is not from me. This is from a textbook. Okay, this is rapid eye movement. And a home sleep study, although there was an attempt to do some of these at home, and a technologist sitting off to the side in the room. How weird can that get? I mean, you might as well just go to the sleep center and do an actual sleep study. But anyhow, so this is an example of obstructive sleep apnea and a full sleep study. And these are ambulatory, and of course, this is really an exaggeration. In fact, it looks more like a seizure monitor. But because you're going to have belts around the chest and abdomen or belts, a belt around the chest and some flow through the nose and mouth. This looks more like a seizure monitoring thing. I always told my colleagues, this looks like somebody's being monitored for seizures and epilepsy. Okay. Let's look at the approach. So now you've diagnosed your patient and you want to discuss treatment options. If you have to always consider behavioral treatment, and weight loss is essential. Like all of you practice good medicine, you want to practice good medicine, implying that you want to make sure that these patients have a good, healthy diet, nutrition, and that they lose weight. If they lose weight, losing weight improves obstructive sleep apnea. Why? Because fat infiltrates in the tongue, and therefore now making the tongue bulkier, which means it crowds the upper airway. There's parapharyngeal fat pads as well. So to make a long story short, you could use weight reduction programs to assist. And with these bariatric procedures that are being done to alleviate significant amount of weight loss, those patients can reduce their workload of ventilation and their workload of breathing. But just a few words on the weight loss and bariatric surgery. You already recognize that those individuals have a higher incidence of obstructive sleep apnea. But throughout the years, I've seen a lot of those individuals. Some of them are my patients that are from you. And they see the bariatric doctor and they said, after you have the surgery, you could set your insulin aside, you could set your blood pressure aside, medication, and that CPAP thing, you don't need to do that anymore. Okay, Well, I like to reflect this on you just for a moment. That is not actually always correct. The majority of the patients who have obstructive sleep apnea undergo bariatric surgery, significant weight reduction, they still have a higher incidence of obstructive sleep apnea than the general population. Their apnea apopnea severity improves to the point they get off the machine. It's been my experience, you follow those patients long enough, it doesn't go away. It gets better. The desaturations markedly improve. The work of breathing reduces, but it's still there. So the name of the game is follow those individuals. Very important. I have a subset of patients that have positional sleep apnea. There are many gizmos and gadgets that are used nowadays to prevent patients from positional therapy. One of the neatest ones that I saw, it's like a little rectangular thing, and it's like a choker, is it? It's a thing that fits around the neck. And when it recognizes you went to your back, you calibrate it. When it recognizes when you go to the back, it vibrates, which is in kind to a harness that's in between the shoulder blades that when you turn to your back, the brain awakens because you're laying on this tennis balls or things that you're laying on your back, extra pillows, et cetera. So positional therapy in some individuals after a sleep study discloses that this is all purely positional, then that might be a method of intervening and treating patients. Avoid alcohol and tobacco. Tobacco, again, doesn't really make obstructive sleep apnea worse. They thought it was irritants of the upper airway and that kind of stuff. Alcohol, because it's you can substitute any opiates and all that in there. That increases the propensity for upper airway, plus suppresses a respiratory drive. Now, there are specific treatments for sleep apnea, and we're going to just touch about these because we're going to talk about the standard of practice. Positive airway pressure, oral appliances. And in the audience, there's an oral appliance physician out here, so I'm sure he'll put his input in on that. But the standard of practice for the treating obstructive sleep apnea is positive airway pressure, which is called CPAP. There are different ways of delivering positive airway pressure. The majority of the patients who have purely obstructive sleep apnea do not require BiPAP, bi-level system. With the new systems that are out there nowadays, they have expiratory pressure release triggers that when you exhale, the pressure gives, that allows ventilation and less resistance on exhaling, making the device easy to ventilate. They're self-adjusting automatic CPAP machines, and they're unbelievably easy to use, especially compared to what we had in the past, and which is what the self-adjusting self-adjusting positive pressure devices are. We're going to touch upon these just a little bit at a time. So what are the indications? If you notice, it says respiratory distress index greater than 30. So I apologize for not letting you know that mild sleep apnea is defined as the number of events per hour is 5 to 15. Moderate sleep apnea is 15 to 30. Greater than 30 to 40 is considered to be severe. And why is that important? Because there's a lot of statistics looking at Wisconsin cohort studies looking at patients with apnea index and cardiovascular, cerebrovascular risk factors. And clearly, patients that must be treated, even if they have no symptoms, like the guys that come to you and says, I don't have any of this. This is a bunch of bupkis. If that's the number of events are greater than 30 per hour, even if they don't have symptoms, you should consider treating those because of the morbidity and mortality and the morbidity conditions seen with cardiovascular, cerebrovascular disease. Now, 5 to 15 mild sleep apnea is of question whether it has significant cardiovascular implication. And that's kind of been brought up several times in the meetings year after year after year. So do we need to be aggressive in those patients? I would tell you, just depending on their symptoms. The wife's about ready to kill him because he snores so loud and his apnea index is 7.5. Of course you're going to treat that individual. You want him to live, right? Unless the wife has a good life insurance policy on him. However, once it's 15 to 30, it's somewhat of a gray zone. And so there's still some data still coming out that looks like it also has clinical significance, but not as much as when it's above 30 per hour. So again, you treat patients that are greater than 30, 5 to 15 if they have impairment of any one of these components, which includes cognitive, depression, mood disorder. I see a psychiatrist out there, and cardiovascular, cerebrovascular disease as well, and mood disorder. I apologize. Okay, so this is the upper airway, a cartoon representation. It's being obstructed. You apply some sort of interface. Interface means mask. That's delivering, it's pushing air. That's why it's called positive, pushing air. It's an air pump device, delivering air pressure to maintain the airway open. As simple as that. That's all that is. And when patients, when we talk about pressure, they think pounds per square inch, millimeters of mercury. It doesn't even come close. It's very mild. And, of course, this is an exaggeration. All you're doing is producing a pneumonic splint to keep the airway open to allow ventilation to occur. And the other thing I tell patients is it does not ventilate for you. You don't have a respiratory insufficiency condition. You don't need to be ventilated. All you need is just to splint the upper airway with air pressure so you can ventilate. There are many reasons to consider positive pressure, but it's not within its limitation. And all of you that have seen either my patients or have your own recognize that patients will say they're compliant, but in reality, they're really not that compliant. Well, as technology improves, nowadays, these devices emit cellular information to the cloud, which has accessibility either to you as a physician or to myself, their treating sleep doctor. And guess who else has that information? Big old government has that information, because if they don't use their device, the device will be asked to be returned. And there's the guidelines are minimum 4 hours a night and 70% of the time. Now, those numbers are obtained from our society. Not that we want to limit patients with CPAP, but that is what it's necessary to reduce cardiovascular, cerebrovascular events in individuals with obstructive sleep apnea. So those numbers are obtained from our society. So they took that and extrapolate. And by the way, the stop bang questionnaire is also part of getting your sleep study authorized. So take these little notes and go back and apply them, and therefore, when you get your denial, you have your documentation. Okay? So the big issue with compliance, and I can't believe how it's changed my practice, these new devices that keep track of not only apnea, severity, and so on and so forth, but it also keeps track of air pressure, mass leak, mass fitting, and feedback, getting the patient involved, interacting with this has exponentially increase the compliance rate of my patient population. So a footnote is get your patients involved in their health. And I know you know that already. I just was added it from my perspective. Now, in medicine, just like in general, you in psychiatric patients, you treat them with medication, and they come into you, say, I'm feeling depressed, and you ask them, are you taking your medication? And they look at you right in the face. They go, yes, I am. In monitoring patients with CPAP, you can't hide. Unless you place it on your dog or your family member and all that, then it's possible. And I used to have like a slide cartoon, but I didn't think this was a good place for that. The patient's talking to his doctor on the phone saying, the doctor asks him, are you compliant? And he's on the phone with the dog next to him with a CPAP mask on saying, yes, of course I'm compliant. I'm using my CPAP every single day. So to make a long story short, CPAP is a great way to do long-term monitoring in those patients. What's made an improvement also is not only the types of mask interfaces. There are about 35 styles. There are many different types of mask interfaces. The devices have markedly improved for ease of ventilation and ease of breathing. They're portable. They're transportable. You could travel anywhere. TSA knows about them. Any patient that tells you it's an excuse, it's bupkis. They just don't want to use it. And, you know, I face them and I ask them, you know, you don't feel like taking it because you don't feel like it. Oh, okay, yeah. Don't tell me a story, you know. All right, so humidification has also made a big difference, not so much down here in the South, but up in the Northeast and the Midwest. Humidification added to the CPAP has been very helpful. Just a word or two about oral appliances, the alternative to positive airway pressure after you implemented some of the behavioral interventions is the oral appliance. They've gotten a lot of publicity now. They've been around for 35 years, okay? So it isn't yesterday. The mouth guards that you hear about and all that nowadays, oh, it's new. No, it's not new. It's just the new, there's a lot more prospective studies looking at the efficacy of these devices. And the way that it works is since your hypopharyngeal and your lingual muscles are attached to the mandible, if you move that mandible forward, and you could do that as you're sitting right there and put your hand underneath your chin and just move your jaw forward, you could feel those muscles moving forward. And so the mechanism is advancing the mandible as one of the systems work and opens the lower part of the upper airway. So the oral appliances or mandibular splints or mandibular advanced devices, and even they have tongue restraining devices, which sounds weird, but they're actually not that archaic, although they do look a little odd nowadays, can be used to open the airway during sleep. So this mouth guard, which looks like the Herbst appliance, is as you turn this notch here, it moves the jaw forward. So how far does it need to be advanced? What are the complications from that? Usually side effects are minimal, dental discomfort, xerostomia with dry mouth, and then jaw discomfort, gum discomfort, but that's temporarily. Long-term, occasional shifting teeth, it depends on the appliance, and then maybe some TMJ. Now, with the new appliances nowadays, they are very much TMJ-friendly. So if you have a patient with rather significant temporomandibular joint abnormality, I don't know. That sounds like you're pushing it. It may not be your first route of choice. In my practice, because of the age population, no teeth, no appliance. Is that clear? No teeth, no appliance. There is one or two appliances that can be applied to the gums on top. Now, if you think about it, the top is the anchor. The bottom is the one that moves. Okay? So it must hold on to something, right? The anchor, and then the bottom is the one that moves. All right, so I get some of these patients for evaluations. They say, I want that mouth guard. I said, ma'am, you're a dentulist. What do you want to do? But some of them are dentulists, but they have screws. They have implants, and they screw the dentures into them, so they're permanent dentures. That's a viable option, okay? You have to align yourself with a dentist that knows how to do this, and you would be the person in charge to follow those individuals. Don't just put them on an appliance and say, so long. And the dentist is not a medical physician. Obstructive sleep apnea is a medical disorder. You need to follow those patients. Don't let the dentist do it. He's your liaison to connect and assist the patient with other methods of treatment. But to make a long story short, you're responsible for the outcome. And here's, I think that's called a Clearway with a K. Been a while since I've seen that. Okay, down the pike, surgery. There are different phases, phase 1A, 1A, B, and C, and phase 2. Basically, what you're doing with the upper airway is debulking or clearing or opening the upper airway to allow ventilation to occur. Remember I said about the upper airway, how complex it is. It has three basic functions, and it constantly has to move. Constantly moves in different directions in synchrony and dyssynchrony to produce three basic functions. So the challenge of surgery is to allow debulking the area and allow function to occur. And of course, throughout the years, you've had many years, 55 years of practicing, apart from tracheostomy, which is not listed here, which is not done for the last 20 years. But basically, you can operate, and I have pictures of such. I thought this was a very important article to help you understand the surgery. This was from Morrison in 1993 that he looked at these individuals and he looked at upper airway dynamics, wake and sleep, and recognized that 82% of the patients had multiple sites of collapse. Because when I talked to you about the surgery of the uvula and soft palate, that's relatively easy, and there are like 6-7 procedures, but only one removes the entire uvula and part of the soft palate. The purpose of the soft palate is to flop back as you swallow, so food goes down the esophagus, not out your nose. And that's been very well delineated, so that rarely happens. I don't have any patients with that. And, of course, this is a surgical outcome. The only problem with surgery of the upper airway is, I like to remind you, is you have multiple sites. So you have a patient with severe obstructive sleep apnea. He's symptomatic. He doesn't want to do CPAP. He doesn't want to do the dental appliance. Doesn't want to lose weight. That's a patient you don't really want, personally. But, you know, we're here to help patients out. So those individuals, if you got them in the surgical procedure, remind them that it isn't just this little procedure that's done as an outpatient and you go home the same day. It hurts like the dickens. But, you know, if it's a procedure that hurts like a dickens, it's going to resolve in 2 weeks, that would be worthwhile if it worked. Well, does it work? Well, here's the data. This is an old slide, but I apologize for that. But this is the statistics. Anywhere from 9 to 57% reduction of apnea severity. And if it's 60 an hour, 50% reduction is 30 an hour, you're still in the critical area, it doesn't help. So what do you do now? Well, now we're going to operate on the tongue and move your hyoid out, and by that time the patient's going out the door. So before you discuss surgery, you need to explain that multiple levels, perhaps sometimes the ENT physician is very joyously expressing the surgery, but doesn't define that you got to perhaps do more than just a uvula soft palate. Now, this is the hyoid suspension, and so basically they tie a sling from the hyoid bone to the mandibular area and pull it out this way by pulling it, so it pulls the tongue and brings the hyoid muscle forward, opening the upper airway. This is the maxillofacial myotomy. Basically, you're fracturing the upper and lower jaw. I had one patient just recently undergo that because he wanted to, and he was compliant on CPAP, talking about looking for trouble. But nonetheless, I want to share that with you. He did actually very good so far, meaning he's improved so far. You have to follow these patients over time. It always finds a way. What's down the line is, we're almost done, and it's almost time anyhow, is FDA approved, and it's been released, and I've gotten a lot of phone calls from patients, the Inspire. What's this thing I heard? It's a gadget that goes in your throat. Yeah, I said, you're talking about the pacemaker, that instead of the wire going to the heart, it goes to the genioglossal muscles of the back of the throat. What? Yeah, it's a pacemaker that wires go to the upper airway. It's synchronized with ventilation. So at the end of exhalation, beginning of inspiration, it produces a contraction and opens the airway. It was released 10 years ago, lasted 2 years in the market, taken off the market, brought back 2 years now. They've changed the electrodes. They don't have the burning and shocking and all that stuff that went with it. And what people will go through not to use CPAP. Nonetheless, having said that, so before I recommend it to my patients, and there are physicians in town that are actually doing those. So before I recommend that in my patients, I want to see prospective studies. What I'm trying to say is, which are the patient populations is this indicated for? All right, so because right now, to me, it's not clear, and our society is trying to figure that out and looking prospectively behind and see what the outcome is. And then one last thing is pending, and there's some clinical trials being done in your area here and down in Dade County with hypoglossal nerve stimulation. Again, locking it into at the end of exhalation, beginning of inspiration, sending electrical discharge, and contracting the dilatory muscles of the tongue. So why treat obstructive sleep apnea? First of all, to improve your life expectancy, your partner doesn't kill you. Number two, alleviate symptoms related to sleep apnea, which includes cognitive problems, daytime sleepiness, reduce cardiovascular risk factor, pulmonary hypertension, if that's the case, hypercapnia, et cetera. And last but not least, when do you refer a patient to the sleep center? Anytime you want. But apart from that, I think more importantly is, as you guys know, sleep apnea is a dime a dozen. They're all over. They're right in front of you and your patients. Just ask. So when is it time to refer a patient to a sleep center? When you need help. For example, the case doesn't respond to therapy, is intolerant to therapy. You start him on what you think was important, and the patient doesn't respond to therapy. The other characteristics is when the sleep history is complex. My favorite consultation in the office is, what's the reason for the referral? Sleep disorder. What? There's 88. Which one? Sleep disorder. You mean you didn't ask questions? Okay, that's all right. I don't mind. I don't mind doing that. It'd be my pleasure. But, you know, you are being confronted with these patients. Ask a few more questions. Other than, doctor, I have a shitty sleep. Okay, do you snore? Ask questions. If the case is complex, acting out dreams, twitching at night, sleepwalking, we're not related to Ambien, et cetera, et cetera. Hey, you got a complex case. Maybe that's something that you don't want to necessarily tackle as a primary intervention. And then lastly is when the results of a test does not match the patient's symptomatology. And that does happen. There is some fluctuation, variability in milder cases of sleep apnea. And having said that, I want to thank you for your time, inviting me here to talk about one of my favorite subjects. And I thank you for your time. Thank you. I'll take any questions, but not really. No, yes. Questions? No, yes. No? Questions? Oh, Bob. Yes. The question is there a relationship between sleep apnea and you meant REM behavior disorder? REM behavior disorder? Yeah, so there is a lot of stuff in the literature looking at REM behavior disorder is acting out dreams. So anything that disengages you during REM sleep can be an abnormal REM behavior disorder. So there's a condition that's called REM behavior disorder, not related to sleep apnea. But there's no doubt that obstructive sleep apnea deactivates motor pathways in REM, and therefore it's a condition known as pseudo-REM behavior disorder. Typically, they occur in the clinical setting of REM-related apneas. You treat the apneas, the REM behavior disorder disappears. On the other side, REM behavior disorder is relatively common. Males, more common than females, as we get into the older years, often associated with Parkinson's disease or neurologic disorder, not necessarily Alzheimer's, and I'm not talking about sundown and confusional states. And in those particular patients, if they have sleep apnea, you treat sleep apnea, REM behavior disorder improves without treating REM behavior disorder, which is clonazepam. Next question. So the question is a difference between non-restorative sleep, tired, and sleepy. Is there a difference? That's a big question that many times patients don't even know how to answer that. And so I like to relate, and I like to give you my personal caveat with that. I look at it this way. Sleepiness is neck up, and fatigue and tiredness is neck down. What does that mean? If you are sitting and feeling tired and not dozing, that's tired and fatigue and non-restored sleep. If you have a tendency to drift often, that is sleepy. Pathologically, is the pathway similar? Do they often occur together? Yes. Are the pathways similar? I think they're different. And many times patients have a hard time differentiating between non-restored, no, it's wake up in the morning not feeling rested versus I'm not sleepy, doctor. And that's a big challenge for patients to describe it. Personally, I look at that as I'm a lumper, not a splitter. In neurology, you're either a lumper or a splitter. So I'm a lumper. I kind of lump them in one group, and then I work from there to see what I can do to alleviate that. Very difficult to differentiate between one and the other. So I usually use them as synonymous. But I do ask, do you mean you're sleepy? And that's important. Okay? Yes? Okay, so I'll give you my caveat about, a lot of caveats here, about insomnia and sleep apnea. Insomnia implies a state of alertness that gives the patient difficulty falling asleep and staying asleep. Those individuals are hypervigilant. An insomnia patient does not preclude that they don't have obstructive sleep apnea. But when you have an insomnia patient that tells you that he or she is sleepy on top of their insomnia, look out. There's something causing the problem, whether it's medication, circadian rhythm problems, sleep apnea, et cetera. Insomnia patients are tired and fatigued, non-restorative, but they're not necessarily sleepy. And although that's not 100%, but that's a general rule. They're tired, they lay down, they don't sleep. They try to sleep during the day, they can't. They have shitty sleep at night, but they can't. They're hypervigilant. They're extremely connected, can't disconnect. My question to you is always ask the bed partner when they do sleep, do they snore? And, of course, there's a condition called complex insomnia, and that's insomnia with comorbid sleep apnea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. Thank you.